At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at Putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget the banks, forget real estate, forget almost everything else. This recession we're in has boiled down to one four-letter word, J-O-B-S. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Thursday today, the 29th of January. Good to have you here. There has been a fairly orderly and arguably predictable sequence of events in this economy. Home values tumbled, which brought on huge losses at banks that made questionable investments in real estate. That brought on the credit crisis and disrupted consumer spending, and that helped convince businesses that they had to cut jobs to survive, 2.5 million jobs over the past 12 months. And judging by a report out today from the Labor Department, millions more to come. The numbers show almost 6.5 million Americans are now getting unemployment benefits, no matter where they used to work or how much money they used to make. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Recessions usually hit blue-collar workers hardest. So far, the numbers show that's the case this time round, too. Harley Shaken is a labor expert at the University of California, Berkeley. He says this downturn is hitting jobs in every area.
So we can't simply say, well, auto workers are having a tough time or retail workers are really feeling the pinch.
But it's not just blue-collar jobs that are disappearing. Lawrence Michel is president of the Economic Policy Institute. He found the jobless rate among four-year college graduates nearly doubled in 2008 from the year before to 3.7%.
I've tracked those numbers back to 1979, and the highest rate I've seen is in the early 80s, it was at 3.9%. So we're in the first year of this recession, we are nearing the historic high for unemployment among college graduates.
And he says expect the layoffs to continue. John Challenger runs outplacement firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas. He says workers at every level are losing their jobs.
It seems as though companies need to be cutting their costs. They can't just do that at the low end. So many of the layoff and cost reduction programs have focused on white-collar workers.
He says firms get a bigger bang for the buck in terms of savings when they cut their more skilled employees. After all, he says, when there isn't enough business, the need for those skills just isn't there. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Other than your Social Security number, probably the most important digits attached to you in this economy are the ones that make up your FICO score. What FICO actually stands for right now doesn't matter, but the number definitely does. It runs somewhere between 300 and 850. It lets lenders know what kind of a credit risk you are. And more to the point, it helps determine how much interest you pay when you borrow. A new and supposedly improved formula for setting those scores went into effect today.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale looked into whether the recalibration is a good thing for borrowers.
FICO stands for Fair Isaac Corporation. That's the leading provider of risk assessment tools to lenders. Spokesman Craig Watt says the new formula is better at identifying who's a bad credit risk. This revision's been 3 years in the making.
So it, in fact, predates the credit crisis, but we were looking at the same factors that lenders are wrestling with now through the credit crisis, such as how to do a better job of managing risk with borrowers who have a spotty credit record.
The new formula is more forgiving of borrowers who slip up just once with a late payment, and it flags repeat scofflaws. Evan Hendricks, the author of Credit Scores and Credit Reports, says borrowers will welcome a more compassionate risk analysis.
It's heartening to me that their model is going to recognize that the one slip up is not going to trash you as it did under the old models.
Craig Watts of Fair Isaac says most consumers will notice little change to their credit score.
Consumers who want to get a better FICO score should still pay their bills on time and keep credit card balances low. Those rules of the road haven't changed a bit.
The challenge now is to get banks and other lenders to use the new formula, says Evan Hendricks.
We have a whole history of Fair Isaac updating its scoring models, but then the new and improved scoring models not being incorporated by lenders that just don't want to bother to change.
He says that's because of bureaucratic inertia and lenders not wanting to pay for the revamped score. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Sales of those homes that FICO scores are so closely tied to continue to plummet. The Commerce Department reported today sales of new homes dropped to the slowest pace on record last month. Prices plunged by more than 9% from a year ago. So try to imagine a more frustrating job than real estate agent, somebody who lives off commissions from homes that just aren't selling. We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out to talk to one of those brokers in a development of high-end homes outside Portland, Oregon.
My name is Carmen Mazia, and I'm with Prudential Northwest Properties.
And what do we go on inside?
Excellent. So this home is 2,600 square feet. It's four bedrooms plus a den, and we are throwing in landscaping and window blinds. It's a great deal. And we're going to go to value range marketing, so it's going to be between 429 and 489, which is a new way to price to attract more buyers, because, to be honest, this price point has been a little bit difficult. I sold one similar to this back in July, and why this is such a good bargain, we sold that for 530.
What is it like to be a realtor right now through this?
Well, right now it's actually a great time to be a realtor because people who weren't serious about real estate have left. So the professionals have stayed. Has it gone down a little bit? Well, some things were overpriced. I mean, I'm not going to lie. But the media has caused this frenzy. And so a lot of buyers are fearful. But people who wouldn't be able to get into a home before can now get into a home. Now, do they take their time? Yes. Do we negotiate? Yes. Do we make sure we're getting them the best deal? Yes. So it's just a different market. It does take more patience. It does take more skill.
That was Prudential broker Carmen Mazia at the custom-built home she's got listed near Portland, Oregon. She was talking to our Mitchell Hartman. Wall Street was weighed down today by that housing report and the unemployment numbers and some other not-so-happy economic news, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Might sound like the lead into a bad joke. Sadly for all of us, it's not. What do you do when $700 billion isn't enough? The new head of the Congressional Budget Office told Congress today he thinks banks are going to need more than the initial $700 billion that was authorized in the TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, perhaps on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars more. The panel that lawmakers set up to keep an eye on how that original pool of money is being handed out issued a new report today on how we might avoid this kind of thing from ever happening again. Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren chairs that committee. Professor Warren, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
I'd like to go back, if I might, before we get to the current report, to the last time you and I spoke, beginning of December, and your interim report on the TARP as it existed then. You had some not nice things to say about the Treasury Department and what they were doing. Has that changed at all?
Well, we're still asking the questions.
Are you satisfied with what the new administration is doing?
We've sent over another letter
explaining what questions have been answered and the many, many questions that are still open. We've asked them to get back to us by a date certain, and I hope that that's going to happen. Look, things are changing. We understand that. They're announcing lots of new policies, and we want to be fair. We want to give them a chance to do that. But at the same time, it doesn't change the fact that this is the taxpayers' money. We still have a responsibility, and we're still going to keep asking those questions until we get some answers.
You met with the Treasury Secretary yesterday, the new Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner. How did that conversation go?
It was very nice. I will say this about the secretary. He at least understands what the problem is, that the American people want to know what's going on and that they have a right to know what's going on.
Let's get to the report that came out today on regulatory reform. As the title sort of implies, you think, your panel thinks, more rules, more regulations are critical to preventing this from happening again.
What this panel says is that we came out of the Great Depression with some key new financial regulations, and they kept us safe for 50 years. We began to develop new financial products, and we had a choice. We could have decided, hey, that means we need to innovate and change our regulations, make them a little smarter, or we could leave these new products unregulated and we could start deregulating the old ones. We chose the latter path. And what happened? We hit the S&L crisis in the late 1980s. We hit another crisis late in 1998. We hit another one in 2002. And now we're in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. It's not that we want more regulation. It's that we are not appropriately regulating a lot of new financial products that have hit the market. We need to do better.
What hope do you have that in the current political environment in Washington, which is proving to be less bipartisan than anybody had hoped, that your recommendations will be adopted?
Well, it's not a question just of our recommendations being adopted immediately. I think the first thing that happens is that we have to frame what went wrong. And when we frame what went wrong, that begins to shift the whole debate. I think that our specific recommendations will be important as that discussion goes forward. What we've done is we've brought them 8 things that we could do to make sure that we don't recreate this problem and get ourselves back into the same mess.
Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel on the Troubled Assets Recovery Program, the TARP, and we'll have a copy of her committee's report on our website. It's marketplace.org. Professor Warren, thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
A state judge here in California sided with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger today. He ruled the governor does indeed have the power to furlough hundreds of thousands of state workers. 2 days off a month without pay should save about $1.3 billion through June 2010. Thing is, it's not clear there's money to pay the bills coming due next month, let alone next year. There's a $40 billion budget gap here. And unless Schwarzenegger and lawmakers can agree soon on what to do about it, taxpayers and students and business owners might wind up getting stiffed right alongside state workers. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, Marianne Russ reports.
California has been short on cash for a long time. Just ask State Controller John Chung. He signs the checks.
The last day the state had positive cash balance was July 12, 2007.
Since then, the state's been raiding the piggy bank, borrowing money set aside for oil spill prevention or traffic safety to keep things running. It's been borrowing from Wall Street, too. But those options are just about exhausted. Chung says if lawmakers don't come up with a budget fix soon, California could do the unprecedented, default on a bond payment.
If we default, it would be the equivalent of a nuclear meltdown in terms of financing here in the state of California.
That's because it would cost the state a lot more to borrow in the future. So Chung says California simply has to put off some payments, starting next week.
Good afternoon, Sacramento Technology Group.
That's what George Yusey is nervous about. He owns a small IT firm near Sacramento. Half of his business contracts are with the state. He expects California will owe him about $400,000 next month. If the delay drags on, he'll have to make some tough calls.
I have no other choice but to either reduce staff or to find other states or other areas to do business or to close my business altogether.
Like many business owners, UC pays himself last. To prepare for the delay, he's cut back at home, canceling services like his security alarm and pest control. State workers and others angry about the expected delays rallied outside the state capitol last week.
My name is Kia Coldrup-Lane. I'm a double major at Sonoma State with political science and liberal studies.
Coldrup-Lane says her student aid check, worth a few thousand dollars, is expected to be delayed. She's not sure what she's going to do.
I would definitely have to get another job, because that's really helpful for a college freshman trying to do a double major. Well, yeah, I would probably have to drop out.
The rest of the country is watching to see whether California can dig itself out of this $40 billion hole. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and lawmakers are meeting daily to try to do that. Any solution is likely to include deep cuts to schools and health care programs. The only bright spot is the federal economic stimulus package. By some estimates, California's share could be more than $20 billion. Governor Schwarzenegger welcomes the money, but he says it would only be a short-term fix.
The key thing here is not to let anyone fool themselves by thinking that the federal government should bail out California, or as far as that goes, that the federal government should bail out any state.
If the cash crunch drags on for a few more months, the controller says he'll have to issue IOUs for a myriad of payments, including state income tax refunds. And state officials are rightly concerned about how the whole mess looks to Wall Street. Over the last couple of months, both Moody's and Standard & Poor's have warned that California's bond rating may go down. It's already tied with Louisiana for the lowest credit rating among all states. From Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ for Marketplace.
Coming up, documenting cubicle life, comic strip by comic strip.
I'm kind of the unofficial voice of the disgruntled. So if anybody's got a beef with anybody about anything, there's a pretty good chance that in, the 20 years of Dilbert, I've touched on it at least once.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back all its gains from Wednesday and then some. It fell nearly 2.75% today, 226 points, ended at 81.49. The NASDAQ didn't do much better. It lost 3.25%, 50 points, finished the day at 15.07. The S&P 500 slid 3.33%, 28 points, closed at 8.45. The picture dimmed at Eastman Kodak today. The photography pioneer posted a fourth quarter loss of $137 million, announced plans to eliminate up to 4,500 more jobs, and saw its shares close down nearly 30%. Investors took Black & Decker to the tool shed after the maker of screwdrivers and toasters warned of slower sales. Shares closed down more than 20% today. Ford Motor Company offset news of a nearly $15 billion quarterly loss with assurances it is not going to need a government bailout. Still, shares throttled down nearly 4% today, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by the Repossessing Virtue Project. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a special guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
from the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on the fourth quarter gross domestic product report. The Labor Department releases its latest employment cost index. And the University of Michigan releases its final January report on consumer sentiment. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Cleveland Orchestra opens its winter season tonight, down in Miami. It's not just a routine stop on tour, and the orchestra isn't just fleeing Cleveland's wicked weather either, even though it is 13 degrees there with the wind chill today. The group is trying to escape the city's frozen economy, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports from Miami.
The Cleveland Orchestra borrowed its big idea from Florida snowbirds. It winters in Miami. For 3 weeks each year, the orchestra performs sold-out concerts, holds master classes, and partners with local arts organizations. It also created a nonprofit to fundraise for the Miami program, something no orchestra had tried before. Gary Hansen is the Cleveland Orchestra's executive director.
This is the first instance of an American Symphony Orchestra creating an annual subscription program and community service presence in another city.
The Miami Residency, in its third year, generates $4 million a year. That's nearly 10% of the orchestra's annual budget. This all started in 2003. Miami was building a state-of-the-art concert hall when its resident orchestra, the Florida Philharmonic, folded. Enter Daniel Lewis, a Cleveland native and former insurance executive living in Miami.
I called the executive director of the Cleveland Orchestra at the time and asked him if they moved orchestras like they move baseball franchises. He said, "You're crazy, but maybe there is an opportunity to do something."
While the Cleveland Orchestra thrives in Miami, other local groups are struggling. The Miami City Ballet is in debt, and the Florida Grand Opera's had to shorten its season. So the orchestra is lending a hand. Tonight, it teams up with the ballet on Stravinsky's Symphony in Three Movements. Afterwards, they'll co-host a $1,000 a plate dinner on the concert hall stage. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Chances are you've spent some part of your life surrounded by three gray panels, about 4 feet wide, maybe 5 feet high, easily recognizable as the standard issue office cubicle. Bland as they are, though, in this economy, cubicles are good enough. And today we're going to continue with Taking Stock, our series of occasional conversations with people who can give us the longer view of our economic situation. Scott Adams chronicles cubicle life in his comic strip, Dilbert. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
As you think about this past year and the mess that we are in, what passes through your mind as you try to translate it into your comic strip?
Well, the great thing is that in this kind of environment, almost everybody that you deal with is trying to screw you. And so that makes great comic fodder. So everybody's kind of a little bit dishonest, maybe not criminally so, but can you really tell if your cell phone service is better than another cell phone service? Or can you tell if you invest in a hedge fund that they're going to invest in anything versus just keeping the money and spending it on fancy clothes?
Do you really believe everybody's trying to screw you out there?
Well, I like to think everybody is, because then I'll be ready, just in case. But, it's good to be vigilant.
Do you think we should have been smarter about this whole thing and maybe had that attitude for the past, 10 years?
Well, if you think about it, most of our problems were caused by some degree of gullibility. I mean, somebody was told, even though you don't make enough money to pay off this mortgage, it'll be all right. Or, in world affairs, we certainly believed a lot of stuff. I won't go into that. But at every level, there was somebody believing something that when you look at it from, historical perspective, you think to yourself, how in the world did they ever believe that?
There is the caveat emptor flip side, though, right? That the buyer does have to be aware and a little bit cynical.
Yeah, but the balance of power has kind of changed because of the complexity of the world. It used to be if you're buying a horse, maybe you could look at the teeth and you could probably tell if you're getting a good horse. But if somebody says, I'd like you to invest in these municipal bonds, and they're insured AA, but then you find out that maybe the insurance doesn't mean anything, and maybe the credit rating is a little bit suspicious, and, you know, everything's a little bit too complicated these days.
You're a guy who seems to get by with a healthy dose of cynicism, but I wonder if your readers appreciate that in the strip.
Well, I think what they appreciate is anytime they see their own situation. I'm kind of the unofficial voice of the disgruntled. So if anybody's got a beef with anybody about anything, there's a pretty good chance that in, you know, the 20 years of Dilbert, I've touched on it at least once. So if you don't like that guy in the next cubicle who keeps using his telephone to make calls on the speakerphone, I've done a couple of comics about that, so you might want to leave those on his desk.
Now, you just went and fired Dilbert. How come you did that?
Well, it just seemed like it was time for him to lose his job and figure out what it was like to be unemployed for a while. I know a lot of people who are unemployed, a lot of people in the neighborhood, a lot of friends. And so I was hearing a lot of their stories while standing in the dog park and other places. And I just thought, you know, I think Dilbert needs to experience this for a while.
What's it going to be like for him, though? I mean, he's, you know, pathetic, frankly, right? So how's he going to fend for himself?
Well, I can't give away too much, but it is true when you take away his structure that he doesn't operate as well. So he's going to be trying to live on his investments. That may not work so well. And then he's going to be looking for a job. So he's going to go through the humiliation of applying for jobs.
Is there a way you think that this economy gets better without a lot of pain?
Well, I think that we were, you know, living on borrowed money there for a while. And once we realized that the borrowed money is gone and nobody has credit to get any more borrowed money, that we're probably in a period of change that will be as fundamental as the, you know, Industrial Revolution. I think that ride sharing will become real because people will find that they just need to, just to save money. I think you'll have more people living in every house, people working at home because they can't commute. So you have a lot of things that if you ask people right now, they'd say, I don't think I want those things. But all of them could actually work out pretty well.
But there are still going to be offices, right? What do you think those are going to look like? I mean, this is kind of your field of study.
Oh, I think that cubicles are going to last forever. But I've always thought that we'd end up moving toward a Hollywood movie studio kind of model where for each project or each product, you kind of gather the people you need just for that effort. And then at the end of it, everybody's a free-range chicken again. And, you know, the internet allows you to do all that stuff. So,
do you think we're ready for that, though? I mean, just having come out of 60 or 70 years of reliable, big companies, everybody has a job. Granted, we move around, but there's some sort of stability there.
I don't know if it's a case of being ready for it, as it is a case of people who don't have options. So if you can't get a job for a big company, you're going to say, well, maybe I'll use my skill and be a freelancer. And a big company might not want to hire you and pay all your benefits, but they might have a project where they need you.
So are we going to see Dilbert as a permanent freelancer?
I can't reveal that, but it would certainly be sacrilegious for Dilbert not to return to his cubicle eventually.
Scott Adams, you know him best from his comic strip Dilbert. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Besides drawing Dilbert, Scott Adams writes a blog on the economy and some other things, too. You can find a link to it and some of his favorite recession Dilbert strips on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today in which President Obama weighs in on reports that Wall Street bonuses came to almost $20 billion last year.
That is the height of irresponsibility. It is shameful. And part of what we're going to need is for the folks on Wall Street who are asking for help to show some restraint and show some discipline and show some sense of responsibility.
That was in the Oval Office this afternoon. If they don't do it themselves, he said, he'll be happy to help them out. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 226 points, 2.75%. The NASDAQ lost 50 points, 3.25%. The S&P 500 shaved off 28 points, 3.33%. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, fretting over England's economic future.
I feel that at the moment we could actually go bust, and I don't think that anybody in charge actually really knows where to go from here.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.